All right. Hello. Welcome. It's the end of the week. It's the nose. I'm very excited. Not that it's the end of the week, although it's been, you know, as they all are, kind of an exhausting week, but a fun week. And we're going to end it in a fun way with a great panel here. Joining us in the studio is Rebecca Castellani, entertainment director at Bridge Street Live in Canton, Connecticut, the very lively entertainment district of Collinsville, actually. And her mom's here today. She's not going to be on the show unless we need her. We have mom.
We can tap her
She's
in
the green room. If we have an emergency, we can get her. Irene Papoulis teaches writing at Trinity College. Bill Usman is director of the Media Literacy and Digital Culture Graduate Program at Sacred Heart University. We've got some topics to talk about. What we did was we all watched Gerald's Game, which is a Stephen King adaptation, which is running right now on Netflix. That'll be part of the conversation that we have in the second half of the show. Before that, anyway, we're going to talk about – actually, it's sort of right up Bill Usman's alley in the sense that we're going to be talking about kind of media literacy. But let me kind of set this up. So almost everybody, I think, has had an experience – Rebecca was just talking to us about one. But we've all had this experience of running into people that we know and like and may have some kind of nice connection to and who seem like good people. But they have read and believed incredibly weird things. A friend of mine patronizes a lovely nursery, like plant nursery in Massachusetts, and where the couple seems very nice until one day they started talking about this fact that that Barack and Michelle Obama had gotten, I believe, Michelle's mother this incredibly lucrative job on the White House payroll. And that was and it was one of these things where you could look it up in about 10 minutes. You could very easily show that it wasn't true. But the world is now full of people who believe stuff like this. And obviously our election was conditioned by, you know, thousands of people who read articles on Facebook that said that Pope Francis had endorsed Donald Trump or that Hillary Clinton was involved in a Pizzagate sex ring and just all this kind of stuff. And if it's placed the right way and it's presented the right way, people believe it. It changes the way they process reality and how they act. So what do you do about it? Well, there's been a couple of things this week that have intrigued me. One of them is you may have seen this article. It was page one of the New York Times yesterday. The idea is in Italy that they are trying to teach as part of public education. They're trying to, in the words of the New York Times, train a generation of students steeped in social media how to recognize fake news and conspiracy theories online. Quote, fake news drips drops of poison into our daily web diet and we end up infected without realizing it, said Laura Boldrini, the president of the lower house of parliament. It's only right to give these kids the possibility to defend themselves from lies, said Mrs. Boldrini. This initiative will be rolled out in 8,000 high schools across the country starting on October 31st. I'll talk about another idea that was floated in Foreign Policy magazine in just a second. But Bill, since this is right there in your job title, we may as well start with you. That I think one of the default position of the media, people like me, is we have to fix this. We have to fix like what the media is. But the truth is, fixing it on our source end may not really do that much, and it may not be that possible. This idea of fixing it on the user end is a little new to me, but maybe not to you.
Yeah, there have been calls for media literacy for a very long time, really, probably starting with the introduction of television and calls for, you know, what that at the time was referred to as teleliteracy. You know, let's figure out how we can become literate about television content. So that's been going on for a very long time. And we should also kind of point out that fake news has been going on for a very long time. It's really not a new invention. What's new is the technologies. What's new is the ability for anyone really to be able to create and disseminate the most ridiculous nonsense in this really, really powerful way without needing to be a media professional. So to a certain extent, I would agree with you, Colin, that it's really going to be impossible to fix this from the source point of view because we are all the media now. There isn't any longer just the media, which are these institutions outside of ourselves. We all are the media. We all are creating media. And there's no way that every single person who has the ability to do that is going to do it in an ethical and responsible way. So we do need to learn how to swim in that new environment. And I do think that that requires media literacy, and it requires media literacy in a very extensive, well-distributed, well-funded, and powerful kind of way, which Europe has been ahead of the United States in terms of this for quite a long time.
I think it's kind of funny, though, that, this is like, we think of this as something new to teach media literacy, because haven't we been teaching people to, you know, be skeptical of sources ever since we've been teaching people, you know? And so I sort of feel like, is it because Europeans are better educated that they, you know, quote unquote, whatever that means, that they're more willing to sort of point to media literacy as a problem? I don't know. But I sort of feel like that's what I've been teaching, you know, for 30 years or however long I've been teaching. And that is sort of the point of education, is a critical mind that is skeptical of sources and is willing to say, wait a minute, you know, okay, you're saying this, but what are your sources? I mean, we supposedly have been teaching that ever since, as long as we've been teaching anything. And so it's interesting to is there something about media literacy that's different from regular literacy?
But I also feel like, I want to get to Rebecca in just a second, but there's sort of a physician heal thyself thing that I've been thinking about a lot. This week we've done a lot of shows kind of by accident that touch on this topic, and yesterday, full-length show with Kurt Anderson where we talked a lot about it. I bet you I could go on the campus of Trinity and find professors and certainly students who have all kinds of really wacky ideas about genetically modified food and how it's absolutely a must that you have to avoid it. It's so dangerous, genetically modified food.
And vaccines.
Yeah. Well, we could come to that. I'm on the safer of these two squares.
Sorry.
You know, and most of that is based on nothing. Most of it doesn't hold up to rigorous analysis. I mean, I actually think all of us have heads full of claptrap.
But is that the fault? Is that because we don't? You know, I was thinking about that too. I was thinking that if somebody told me something about something that I believed in that was fake news, I would probably be much more likely to say, "Oh my gosh, that must be true. That's amazing." Like genetically modified food, for example. You know, I probably wouldn't if somebody said, "You know, that corn that you're eating is really messed up because it has all these pesticides." I would probably believe it. I wouldn't say, "Oh my gosh, I have to go check my source and make sure that's true." You know, so I guess it's true that people want to believe. It's already people have a mindset that they want to believe something, and then they sort of they're less skeptical about information.
Well, I mean, Rebecca, there's so many ways to go about this, but since we're going to break the other glass and get our millennial out of the diorama, I mean, I don't know. Do you feel so? Bill's saying, and I think he's right, that the digital part of this is one of the things that makes it more pernicious. And certainly, if I'm a smart digital user and I want to spread lies about something, you know, all I have to get the right story, maybe targeted using analytics in front of 150,000 people. Maybe I can change 70,000 votes. I can win a presidential election that way. But I'm also wondering whether you feel like you've got a different set of goggles on as a millennial. That maybe you're a little bit more used to the idea that digital is often manipulating.
Yeah, no, I certainly treat everything that I see that's, you know, purely digital content. I think that journalism used to be this sacred cow, and now this idea that clickbait and raw hits is more important than the sanctity of what you're producing. I mean, I tie that all into this whole idea of things going viral. I mean, you weed through all these videos of things that somebody said, oh, my mom found a coyote and brought it in, and it was somebody's dog. I mean, it takes so much effort to parse through what's real and what's not that I tend to just sort of say, take it all at face value and say, that's a funny video, that's a funny meme, who knows how accurate it is. So it's made me very skeptical of the validity of a lot of the stuff that's being presented to me. I mean, I do find that even something as innocuous as a Slate article or a Vice article or something like that, you really do have to dig a little further and be a conscious consumer of media. And I think that is a fairly new phenomenon, because before we kind of accepted a lot of this stuff at face value, and now we have this whole keyboard warrior fact-checking thing, which is great in some senses. But to me, I think we are putting more emphasis on the reach than we are on the quality. You know, it's quantity over quality of what you're consuming, and it's hard to police that. So you again, it all comes back to conscious consumerism.
Well, Bill, it's also kind of a philosophical problem here too. I mean, there's a bunch of them, but I want to mention Cicely Bock for the second time in 2 days. But I mean, her book Lying, which she published in 1978, a philosophical treatise on lying, one of the things she says, describing the environment that Rebecca now lives in, she describes it as a hypothetically impossible environment. If in fact you feel as though you're being lied to most of the time, or you might be and you have to check everything, I mean, you can't function in an environment like that. I mean, if every statement that you get requires some kind of rigorous investigation on your own part, you can't live.
Well, then what is journalism then at that point? You know, it changes the whole nature of the construct.
Yeah, and so there is that trap. There's that nihilistic, cynical rather than skeptical trap that I hear from a lot of my students. Like, I don't trust anything. Nothing is true. And so I'm just going to kind of give up.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, I think that plays perfectly into the designs of powerful forces. I don't think it's accidental that the Trump administration rolls out the term fake news anytime that there's something that is critical of them or something that they don't like, you know, because it's an inoculation. It means that nothing can be trusted except the voice of the dear leader. And then you're just kind of giving up and, you know, let's party like it's 1999 because there's nothing that we can do about this. And there has to be a way to work around that cynical, nihilistic trap that this can create.
I mean, I feel like one way to work around it is really to publicize, you know, like, the New York Times is a very different source from a random internet source, and people don't even understand what that means and why the New York Times is so different, you know. And I guess that is part of Trump's ideas to try to like sort of paint them all with the same brush, you know. But so I would say maybe one step is to publicize more what it really means to be a journalist, you know, like how you check your sources, how those sources get checked, how those sources get rechecked, where the attempt to, I mean, does that affect you as a millennial to know that?
Yes, but the problem with the New York Times is it's not readily accessible. You have a certain number of articles you can read per month, and then you have to pay for it. So, you know, there is that distance where it's hard, you know, busy taking in content, and someone's got, you know, 5 minutes on their commute to read something. Are they going to sign up for a New York Times subscription because they want the highest quality journalism? In my experience with millennials, no.
Somebody named Sarita is tweeting us about a bunch of things, including the business of media has degraded the craft of journalism. Can't argue with that. People have to be willing to pay for content. Quote, all caps, you get what you pay for. And so, I mean, that sort of addresses what you're saying, too.
Yeah. And which I agree. I mean, like anything, it's quality over quantity, and you got to expend money to get quality news, I guess, in this case. But for a lot of people, that's either not financially feasible or they don't care enough to take that extra step and put their credit card information so they can have unlimited New York Times access. It's tricky. And I do think the New York Times is one of the few, you know, the last strongholds of good, clean media that, you know, publishes retractions and edits and takes ownership for, you know, the few instances where they do misprints and stuff like that, whereas you don't see that with smaller publications that are more viral, like, you know, your dime a dozen think pieces that show up on your newsfeed.
But there is also the problem that we can't just put our faith in the big media institutions, because if you look at the New York Times, for example, yes, there's a difference between the New York Times and some, you know, random blogger who's just kind of making stuff up. But if you look at the New York Times during the run-up to the Iraq War and the way Dick Cheney had access to reporters and was planting stories and then citing them on the morning news shows, and Judith Miller was just accepting anything that was coming out of the White House and it was appearing on the front page of the New York Times, that was also fake news. But we didn't think of it as fake news at the time, and it helped to lead us into the war.
Yeah, but we learned something from that. And I think the New York Times learned something from that, right? So in a way, it's an exception that proves a rule, right? Because maybe it won't. Because there is sort of it's true that sometimes it doesn't work, but still, at least it.
But I could give you some post-exit, post Judith Miller examples of the New York Times not having learned that lesson too. I mean, I could give you chapter and verse on them and stuff that they've just never dealt with.
Yes.
And certainly.
No, I want to believe in a big institution.
Sorry. I mean, it's a great institution. Yeah. By and large, a great institution. It's not, as Bill is saying, it's not an infallible institution.
Right.
And I mean, you know, everybody knows that John Kerry said, "Who among us does not love NASCAR?" Except Maureen Dowd made that up. All right. He never said that. All right. So, and there, I mean, I could go on. I think the other problem is, okay, the other aspect of this is the digital revolution that started somewhere around 2000, between 2000 and 2004, was fueled, as Bill is suggesting, at least by the belief of some bloggers who were starting some of the news blogs that became very, very popular, the kind of Daily Coast level blogs. One of the things that they would say to people like me, and I had this directly in my face, is, you know what the difference between you and me is? You get a paycheck. That is absolutely the only difference. You got no training. They're right. You have no certification. You know, like, there's things you have to know to be a plumber. You can't be a plumber if you don't pass certain things. You have to get a license. I don't have any license. I don't have any training. They're absolutely right. And one of the things they said is, so what's so great about you? You guys make mistakes. You miss stories. You overemphasize certain things. You work in packs. You chase around one thing and ignore another thing. Why aren't we every bit as good? And I'm not sure that journalism has come up with a really good answer to that yet. Except vetting, right? Vetting, like, you know.
Vetting is a big answer.
Yeah.
Having an editor.
Right. That helps. I didn't mean to stall the conversation there. Well, so, okay, one of the other things that was proposed by Foreign Policy is the kind of consumers union model, that somehow or other there would be some kind of citizens movement that would then come to resemble the consumers union, which then turned out Consumer Reports, that somehow or other would work that way for information. And Irene, I mean, one problem question I have about it, so we live in a time where basically the response is to discredit whatever. So in other words, if you have a fact-checking organization working out of the Poynter Institute or the Annenberg Center or the Washington Post, the people who don't like the fact-checking say, oh, well, you're just big part of the big Eastern elite lying apparatus anyway. So who cares if you fact-checked it?
And I would say that's the propaganda right there to say that. But I also think, all right, so another rule of thumb should be that you always do what I'm sure all of us do, which is if you see a story you want to look that you have any kind of skepticism about, you want to say, okay, what's everybody else saying about it? You know, and so the more, and that if that's what they do, I mean, I trust them. I mean, you know, I trust those kind of organizations, but maybe that's just because I'm not a millennial, and you know, it's, I think it's true that it's millennials tend to be more skeptical on the whole. But I think if people are trained and rigorous in their approach, and they're going to publish retractions, and they're going to try to get to the truth, that makes a big difference.
Absolutely. I mean, I thought Bill's point about skepticism versus cynicism was right on. I mean, I don't necessarily feel that I'm as skeptical as I am. I throw my hands up in the air, exasperated, and saying I don't know what's real and what's not. And the effort required to investigate, I just don't have enough hours in the day to investigate every single article for validity, and that's frustrating.
I'm being texted or something. A lawmaker in the vice president's home state of Indiana has drafted a bill that would require state police to issue licenses to professional journalists. I assume this is different from press cards, which state police often do. Well, I mean, Bill, this is one of the things that I think you and I both teach some of the same stuff when I do teach. And one thing I say to my students is, okay, so when you buy a car, you try to know everything about the car, you know, before you buy the car. When you drive across a bridge, you don't research the bridge. You just assume it's going to work. And that, unfortunately, information is getting a lot more like cars. Like, you almost really do have to ask a lot of those questions about it. But we treat information, not unreasonably, like a bridge that we can just drive across. But I don't know. Then the next thing you have to do is teach that generation of students how to scale that somehow, because as we said, you can't check everything.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's why it can be exhausting, and that institutions count on that exhaustion on the part of the public, because you buy a new car every several years at the most. And, you know, you're taking in new information multiple times a day. Now, you know, constantly, we're never kind of disconnected from the media information environment. And so you, as you said earlier, you can't fact check every single source. You can't, decide I'm not going to listen to this or I'm not going to accept these findings until I've, you know, spent a half hour researching it. That's just impossible, and it becomes exhausting. So it has to become a matter of teaching really kind of ingrained habits of critical thinking, so that we develop kind of a sense of, okay, there's something in here that just doesn't seem right to me. This is something that I need to follow up on. Who was the source of this story? Where did it come from? What is the motivation behind it? But it does have to become kind of an innate thing, so that when I sit down to read, I don't have to consciously think about how to read the words on the page the way I did when I was first being taught to read. And so we have to be able to get to that point where that's true of us for all of our media consumption, that it's ingrained in us, that it becomes something that has become almost natural for us as we're reading to be critically reading, as we're watching to be critically watching.
One thing, we're going to take a break here. One last thought I would leave people with is, you know, it may be important sometimes to disconnect from certain things. This is something Virginia Heffernan, a media critic, has been talking about. She calls it cognitive security. And basically the argument is, you know, if your faucet were connected to a toxic, polluted aquifer, you'd disconnect from it, you know. And you may have the equivalent of that coming into your phone right now. You may ultimately have to disconnect from some of the polluted information sources that you're getting. But it's going to be a hard sell for a lot of people. All right. We're going to take a break. Jonathan McNichol is going to come in here and handcuff all of the panelists to the desks. And we'll explain why when we come back.
I got Kellyanne Conway to spin my facts for me. You got number crunchers.
All right. Poor Jessie. Her marriage to a somewhat creepy older husband with kind of scary looking eyes, played by Bruce Greenwood, who didn't need any makeup for that, is a little flat and stale in the sex department. He sets up a exciting weekend for them at a lake house. This is going to involve I'm, by the way, going to spoil the first 3 minutes of this thing for you. But I mean, really, it's not going to spoil anything, but it will spoil the first 3 minutes. This involves handcuffing her to a bed, which he's going to find very exciting. The problem is he almost immediately clutches his chest and has a heart attack and falls off the bed, and just things really kind of go downhill from there, believe it or not. There are a lot of other problems. I mean, starting with the fact she can't get out of the handcuffs and she's miles from the nearest neighbor, and what is she going to do? This is the plot of Gerald's Game. It's a Stephen King adaptation. It's on Netflix right now. We can laugh and chuckle about it now, but we actually did have to watch it, and it was quite well, some of us watched all of it. I'm going to say that for the first time in my career as a news host, I kind of fast-forwarded around and stuff. I thought, I don't have to watch this whole thing. But Irene, you watched the whole thing, so we'll start with you. So this is, to a certain degree, I don't know how we talk about this part of it without a little bit of spoiling, but this is a story, a little bit anyway, about how a woman tries to find her way out of a really impossible situation. I don't know. I'll just get your reaction to it. You seem to find some redeeming things in this story.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, because I thought the opening scene, yeah, was sort of intriguing. Like, I want to find out what's going on in their relationship, you know, before he died right away. But, you know, sort of like there was a problem in their relationship that they wanted to solve. He thought he could solve it by handcuffing her to the bed. So it's like, okay, yeah, I want to hear what's going to happen now, you know, like, and she's very resistant, you know, she sort of wanted to play along at first, but then she really had some trouble with it. And this all is all in the first minute or two. And I feel like, all right, I want to watch the rest of that. And, you know, so I didn't get any satisfaction. And so I kept thinking about, I think it was trying to sort of analyze her and what her problems were, you know, on some level it was trying to, but it was very much from a male point of view of like, what was wrong with her? Why couldn't she just go with it? Why was she so resistant? You know, and there could have been some interesting answers to that, but the answer. And so I was sort of waiting for, and then it was trying to have like a psychoanalytic drama of sorts that where they were trying to figure out. So that sort of pulled me along, and sort of the horror stuff. I kind of like yeah, whatever. Let's get to the to the psychology. So I don't think I'm the ideal viewer for it, but I think it was giving me enough that I could sort of say, oh, wow, what's going to happen? How are they going to analyze it? But ultimately, I was somewhat disappointed.
All right, before we get to Bill and Rebecca, let's hear a little clip here. Some of the answers that Irene is talking about come from these phantasms that are, appear to be just projections from Jesse's interior life. Some of them are kind of an alternative version of herself, but some of them, because they didn't pay Bruce Greenwood to just drop dead in the first 3 minutes, are her dead husband now talking to her. So let's hear that very censorious dead husband talking to Jesse, who we would like to emphasize is still handcuffed at this point.
Your life support system, you've been unplugged. There's still juice in there, but the charge is running down. And if you don't get out of the cuffs, it will go all the way to zero. When did we get here?
One-ish, I think.
And how long do we got in the bed?
An hour, maybe more.
We call it 2 o'clock then, and I drop dead.
10 minutes maybe after.
When's the sun been setting?
7:15 or so.
Oh, that's pretty close. That's another 15, 20 tops. So let's say 5 hours so far. 5 hours you've wasted screaming for neighbors that are half a mile away if they're even here yet. And you know, if you really think about it,
Nate and Kelly said they
wouldn't be heading up there till June this year. The maids came to prep for us yesterday.
Because the bed is made and the house is dusted.
Which means they're done and gone. And the grass
was cut fresh.
Which means no gardeners. Because I arranged it all to get the place ready for us today. And I wouldn't want them interrupting my little game, so I probably gave them at least the weekend off.
So who could
possibly hear you screaming? Except Cujo over there?
All right, so there's a dog, too. We can't tell you too much about the dog. You can find out about the dog on your own, okay? But Bill, so, I mean, if there's a way to sort of look at this thing, it is kind of a weird form of psychoanalysis in which Jesse really kind of takes stock of who she really is, how she got into this situation, what some of the factors in her early life would have been, because, in fact, there's another phantasm who will show up eventually. From a certain point of view, I mean, an awful lot of fiction is that sort of quest for who I am. I don't know. Did it work for you that way?
It didn't work for me very much at all. It's actually really good that we're talking about it today, because if we hadn't ended up talking about it, I would have been really angry that you made me watch it.
Yeah.
I'm very biased against it. I did not think it was a good film. I did not think it was a story that held up. You know, I think the thing about for me about Stephen King, and I do like some of Stephen King's work. I think The Shining is a great story, both in as a novel and, of course, it was made by one of my favorite filmmakers as a film. But he's so ridiculously prolific that some of it is going to end up just being product. And this felt to me very much like product that was trying very hard to make some kind of profound statement, but was doing it in such a text rather than subtext kind of way, and doing it so heavily handed that it just never connected for me. You know, I think underneath a lot of King's work is this theme that the real horror, the real monsters, are from our dysfunctional relationships with real people. They are the real people in our lives are the ones that actually terrorize us. And I do think that that's kind of an interesting theme in his work. But in this one, it was just so heavy-handed. I mean, at one point, that actually became text. Like, she actually says this at the end of the film. And it's like, okay, thanks for telling us that that's what this is about, as if we couldn't figure it out on our own.
Also, we have 8 seasons of The Walking Dead, or however, to tell us that the zombies become background noise pretty fast.
Right.
It's the living people who are a problem. Rebecca, did you read this book?
I did. I read it this week. So it's very fresh in my mind. I always like to do that. And the entire time I was reading it, I kept thinking, how in God's name are they going to make this into a movie? Because they played up the psychoanalytic elements of it way more. There's 5 or 6 voices that she's dealing with as opposed to compartmentalizing it into an idealized version of herself and her husband, which is what you see in the film. I understand from an editing and a production standpoint why they made that choice, but you lose a lot of the impact that the novel has because it is so derivative in the way the movie has filmed it. Whereas when I was reading it, the handcuffing and all of that, you know, the trauma that she was going through was really secondary towards the work she was doing with these voices. And the voices then start working together, and some of the voices try and lead her astray. And that, to me, was what the novel really was about, and her having to uncover past trauma, to find clues in her past trauma, to get out of the situation she was in. And the way the movie handled it was making it very much more about the bodily struggle she was going through. And they kind of played up that metaphor of, okay, here's a trapped woman who's got to escape. That was less emphasized in the novel. The ending, I will say, of both the novel and the movie is silly. And the novel ending was silly. But I do think the book is much more successful than the film.
Did you feel like the novel satisfied you to some extent in terms of her sexuality or her Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, no, I thought that was handled, you know, because sexuality is such a nuanced, complicated thing, especially if you're someone, she's, you know, suffered some abuse. And I felt that they kind of, you know, the husband was in the film much more diabolically illustrated. His role as a voice, because he wasn't one of the voices in the book, gave him, and obviously it's because they have Bruce Greenwood cast, and he's fabulous. I mean, I thought in general the casting, Carla Gugino was wonderful.
She's really good.
I thought that the acting was actually pretty great. But they did the best they could with what was really just a reduction of the premise of the book, which was very successful. So that would be my advice. Read the book. Don't bother seeing it.
So let me swing this in a different direction. So, Bill, one of the things that we began this week as we formed into a little group and started emailing, you guys were emailing a lot about #MeToo, which is sort of the latest iteration of the Harvey Weinstein sexual abuse scandal. And, you know, it can be a real mistake to look at one thing through the lens of another thing that may or may not be connected. But I couldn't help it watching this movie. I thought, here's this movie that's really kind of at least it sees itself clearly. It regards itself as a movie about female empowerment, like sort of men suck, and you know, ultimately you have to save yourself, and so how are you going to do this, and what are you going to do with your life if you get through something like this? But I mean, the notion that it's a kind of really attractive woman in a kind of sexy 90 whatever that thing was, kind of filmy garment.
She's naked in the book.
You know, she's naked in the book. Shackled to a bed for however long this movie was. You
too
know,
long.
I mean, this is like Harvey Weinstein's idea of a story about female empowerment. Like, you know, you could probably get there some other way, don't you think?
Yeah, I could. I also could not help but think about Harvey Weinstein, which I never want to think about Harvey Weinstein, but I've been forced to lately as I was watching this, just because obviously, right, that's a coincidence just because of the timing of all of this. And I would say that I do think the intentions behind it were feminist, broadly imagined, right, in terms of all of those issues. And it was trying to make a statement, I think, about that, especially as we see, you know, how she kind of recreates herself after, well, spoiler, she escapes from this. I just don't think it did that in any particularly artful way. And there were those elements of it just becoming kind of like this this sexy spectacle. When it first opened, I couldn't help but think about 50 Shades of Grey,
yes,
you know, and the focusing in on the manacles. And to me, that almost seemed very deliberate as well, and that you could get people to watch it by making them think that it was some type of 50 Shades of Grey type story. But then putting her on display like that and you know, I know the sexualization of fear is a big part of horror films in general, or even fairy tales. But the way it did it, I do think it just never really kind of successfully pulls that off.
We should say even that whatever the equivalent of the movie poster is that you see like on your video screen to tell you that the Gerald's Game is coming up shows a woman handcuffed to a bed. I mean they're selling this thing as a movie about a woman handcuffed to a bed. That never really does stop. But see, no, Irene, to me, I was really bothered by this. And of course, I'm sitting there watching all this with my presumably male gaze. And I'm like, I don't want to be
presumably.
Involved. I would like to look at Carla Gugino under certain circumstances. Not these circumstances. On the other hand, if this were a movie about, I don't know, Dustin Hoffman and Steve McQueen trying to get out of some horrible situation where they're handcuffed and, you know, I mean, nobody, I wouldn't maybe have a problem with it. So am I taking away from women the ability to have a really good escape adventure story because I'm kind of offended by a woman being put in that position?
Well, are you offended? You're offended by
her putting in that position?
Yeah, on her behalf, on the woman's behalf? Or how are you offended?
I thought it was torture porn. I thought I was just watching this thing where I was being invited to watch this woman who's in this, you know, nighty. You know,
struggling
against handcuffs for like a really long period of time.
Yeah.
So I was, first of all, I didn't want to watch that. But I thought there was something fundamentally offensive about it, too. I really thought it was voyeuristic as opposed to being, I mean, I you know, it sounds like the book isn't like that. But that's what I thought this movie was.
I have to completely agree with that. But it was because she didn't, you know, I thought it was interesting, Colin, that you said, you know, it could have been about female empowerment, men suck and all that, you know. But that isn't female empowerment to say like, oh, you know, these poor women are the victims of these horrible men, you know, and let them try to escape from it. And then if they're alone, then they're going to be better off because they'll be powerful, you know. I don't see that as a feminist vision at all or a vision of female empowerment. You know, it would have been a much more interesting movie if they had had more of an interaction, you know, like have a conversation and she had had more power. But I mean, you know, if you're handcuffed to a bed and there's nothing you can do, how could you possibly be empowered? You know, you're sort of so. But maybe that's why they don't make movies about Dustin Hoffman being handcuffed to a bed with nothing to do.
That was Papillon, actually.
I guess.
Well,
I guess the empowerment's supposed to come from the fact that she didn't give up, you know, and that she found like this inner strength. I saw these manifestations as like, you know, is this her id or her super ego that's, you know, kind of coming out to spur her on? And she did find this inner strength. There is, you know, there was that James Franco movie about the hiker,
right.
You know, who gets trapped has to, you know, literally saw off his own arm to escape.
I thought about that movie a few times.
Parallel here, and that was supposed to be kind of like a story about the human triumph, like, and that's so much of Hollywood. So many
it's such a male
films.
It would have benefited from a female director.
Yeah,
I'll say that if we'd had a woman in the helm, I think this would have been a different film. Especially,
well, I think that is true. Actually,
Stephen King's book is not as. Because I hate this whole idea that women have to be put in like a physically degrading situation to gain their empowerment.
Yeah.
Like, why does it always have to be so bodily and based in you know, real physical suffering? And that's the metaphor for you free yourself from your metaphorical shackles of your mind. I mean, I thought that was a little derivative and silly. But in the book, you know, she's first of all not in a sexy nightie. She's naked. She's feeling very vulnerable like that. She goes to the bathroom, all these things that we edit out so it maintains this idea that Carla Gugino, even when she's, you know, bleeding and starving and thirsty, is still hot. Like, she still appears in a sexually charged way, which was completely absent from the book. I mean, by the end of the book, the image I had of this woman was harrowed and, you know, covered in her own bodily mess. I mean, that was so much more visceral and real and worked so much better than this idea that, oh, you know, she still looks pretty cute and she's going to drive in her car and still look kind of hot. And the other benefit, I think, of the voices in the book was that they were all female voices.
One of the
primary voices is her college friend Ruth, who was this strong feminist that tried to encourage her to talk about some of the past traumas she's had. And the letter, she writes a letter at the end of the movie, and that letter is actually addressed to the college friend and kind of apologizing for shutting her down and opening up this invitation for them to rekindle their friendship. And it becomes about strong females building each other up. And that was really absent, I thought, in the conclusion of the film.
Yeah.
We should mention that this film also features as kind of a disturbing apparition, this huge hulking death-like figure who somebody here figured out was the person who played Lurch in the last iteration of the Addams Family. So there's that to look forward to. All right. So
we don't recommend it.
Maybe I should just save this for the recommendations. But I'd be interested to hear you guys just very quickly talk about, like, I was sort of thinking about this afterwards, like, what's my idea of a movie that maybe does this in a less, like, I think Bill's right. There's something just so ham-fisted about its attempts to be to be something other than what it really is. You know, and I even think of like Amy Adams, I think, is piling up some roles where she
Arrival.
Arrival in particular. Yeah. She plays this strong, interesting woman who has a source of tremendous sorrow inside her too, you know, but who doesn't flinch from anything, you know. She just goes in and
I would be surprised if Gerald's going to pass the Bechdel test, even though it's a woman talking to herself the entire time.
Yeah,
I mean,
my wife brought that up when we were talking about that.
That's interesting, but it's a single character in a room and you're still having relationships, conversations that are really only grounded in her relationships with men. And in the book, they play up, again, I keep harking back to this, her relationship with her mother is more prominent, and her mother's, you know, being complicit in a lot of the stuff she suffered. That was interesting to me, and it was less gendered. This felt very much like this is a woman who's going to free herself from these shackles of all the toxic men that have harassed her over her life. I mean, I don't know. I can't think of a movie off the top of my head besides maybe some Amy Adams stuff that is successful in that.
I Am Love, Tilda Swinton. Oh my God. I just love that movie so much.
She's amazing.
She has shackles of a social, of a different sort, and it's kind of about a kind of escape, but it's completely different from
She's a dream. This.
All right. Did you have one? Or
yeah, I just saw Battle of the Sexes, which I really would recommend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, Billie Jean King had her own shackles beyond what happened on the court. And I thought it did a good job with that.
My contribution will be 20th Century Women, which I saw last night. This is Mike Mills' second movie about one of his parents. He doesn't have any more parents to make movies out of. He also made Beginners about his father. It's Annette Bening. But it's really three women played by Elle Fanning, Greta Gerwig, and Annette Bening. Three women of different ages in 1979 in coastal California. Really kind of talking about some of those questions about, you know, what is feminism? But doing it in a really entertaining way, all in the company of a 15-year-old boy and a kind of manly carpenter mechanic kind of guy played by Billy Crudup. It's a terrific movie, and it's very entertaining, but also explores a lot of interesting questions about what, you know, what feminism is and what it really means to be a woman triumphing over her circumstances without ever getting very didactic. Anyway, we're going to take a break. We're going to recommend other stuff after that.
I could just get out of these handcuffs. I could do the credits. Kai! Come on, Mr. Rizdahl, this isn't funny anymore. Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish would have helped, but she's all tied up. Part of Lurch was played by Bill Curry. On Monday's show, we debrief our reporting team freshly returned from Puerto Rico. And now, back to Colin.
Here we are. We're back. We like to recommend things to you at the end of the show. We already just did recommend a whole bunch of things, and I am, in fact, dying to see Battle of the Sexes. But Irene Papoulis, what do you have to recommend?
I have, first of all, I've just been feeling really sluggish lately, and I don't know what's going on. And so somebody said, why don't you stop?
So you're
going
to recommend cocaine.
Why don't you stop eating animal products for 2 weeks? So I stopped about a week and a half ago, and it's really makes some kind of internal change and difference. Even if you're not going to completely become a vegan, to do it temporarily is I highly recommend it. And I also recommend Jane Meyer's interview of profile of Pence
stealing,
in the New Yorker from the New Yorker. So interesting to hear about him.
All right, so. And actually, you stole from both people because Rebecca, of course, you know, radically changed her diet when she felt sluggish.
Really?
But anyway, we'll go to Bill Usman next.
So my oldest daughter loves that you've just said stop eating animals. She gives you two thumbs up. I also was going to pick the Jane Meyer. It's her piece in this week's New Yorker called The President Pence Delusion. And it's a investigation of how he really is, in addition to his, you know, evangelical Christianity, his anti-gay stance, his anti-woman policies. He's also the voice of the Koch brothers inside the Trump administration. And, you know, just the title of the piece alone, The President Pence Delusion, she really lays out how we cannot rely on impeachment or the 25th Amendment as somehow the solution of getting us out of this nightmare that we're in, because what might be at the other end of that would also be a nightmare. And in general, I can recommend Jane Meyer just across the board. Everything she does is crucial and important.
And there's great details in there, too, about, you know, his mother and about his father beating him.
Now, do you mean his real mother or his wife that he calls mother?
His real mother. And it helps you understand why he calls his wife mother after you meet his real mother, who's still alive.
A lot of the article is actually Mike Pence chained to a bed and all these different people from his past are talking to him.
Kind of.
But actually, it's funny that you're doing this. We're going to get to Rebecca in just a second. But because one of my ideas for recommendation, which I had last week, but then I didn't do it, so I carried it over to this week, was, and it seems kind of stupid, but just The New Yorker. And what I mean by this is that, you know, the physical New Yorker, if you get it, you know, and it sits in your house and it piles up and it's reproachfully looking at you from its stack of New Yorkers. But you, when you get to it, you wind up reading about stuff that you wouldn't necessarily have picked out. They picked it out for you. It's almost inevitably reported at a level and with a depth and narrated with a kind of artfulness that you just don't see much of anywhere else. They really still are head and shoulders just about anybody above anybody else you can think of at what they do. And I feel as though, you know, when I do get to that pile and, you know, read five or six articles, my understanding of reality gets a lot sharper in just the way that Bill was describing about the Jane Mayer article. And so
Tillerson played the drums in a marching band. The Tillerson article.
The Tillerson article in particular was about three or four issues ago. It's the red and black cover one. That's how I think of it.
The New Yorker is part of the solution to what we were talking about in the first segment.
Yeah. And what they do with the New Yorker Radio Hour, too, where they've actually almost overnight been able to translate a lot of their ethos into this very difficult medium of radio also is enviable. I mean, David Remnick is like this guy who also – he's like a kind of journalist who almost hasn't ever existed before. I mean, if you think all the things that Remnick does and the people who want to talk to Remnick – you know, I mean, where he can say without almost affectation, well, I talked to Barack Obama 3 weeks after the election. He said, you know, and it doesn't even seem like he's name dropping. It's probably Obama probably called him, you know. So anyway, New Yorker is part of my recommendations. But Rebecca Castellani, what are you going
to
recommend?
So to redeem Stephen King a little bit, I highly recommend his very short autobiographical book called On Writing. It functions both as a wonderful exemplar of how one goes about a professional career in writing, but also functions as sort of an autobiography of his writing career. You know, he talks about the first time his book was picked up and those feelings and his struggles with it. So I would really recommend that. It's really short. You can read it in an afternoon if you're interested in writing or just interested in Stephen King. It's a really wonderful insight into his process. My second endorsement is if you're like me and you're overwhelmed by everything in the internet, everything that you intake, tonight, and I think tomorrow night, is the Orionid meteor shower. So if you're interested in going out and retreating into the cosmos, now's a nice night to do it because it'll be clear and I think you'll see some really cool meteors.
Leave your phone at home.
Yes, unless you've got that very cool, which is actually an endorsement of itself, the Night Sky app that identifies based on your GPS the constellations around you and shows you know if a satellite goes by, what satellite it is, where certain things are happening, and that's free. So if you're looking at the sky and you can't figure out what you're supposed to be looking at, download that.
There's an app for that. All right. So, yes, I will say that I interviewed Stephen King on stage at the Bushnell a few years ago, and the On Writing book was the most useful thing for me in terms of preparation. I mean, it's not only great preparation for all the things that you described. It's great preparation for Stephen King, too. You really get to know him through that book in a way that I don't think we've ever gotten to know him before. So it's really kind of a memoir that's couched as a book about writing. So I'm also feeling like people are overwhelmed and they also might need to laugh. And I always feel like that the movie Bowfinger should be one of the top 10 comedies on everybody's top 10 comedy list. But I'm just always amazed by the number of people who haven't seen this movie, including Kurt Anderson yesterday, Jonathan McNichol, who seems to see every comedy movie. It's a terrific movie. I guess I could really
I've never heard of him.
Bowfinger. So it stars Steve Martin and Eddie Murphy. Steve Martin plays an unscrupulous, down on his luck movie director who is working with a very kind of dilapidated crew and no money whatsoever. Eddie Murphy plays two roles. He plays an action star named Kit Ramsey, who is unbelievably paranoid and has joined a Scientology-like movement called Mindhead. It's just clearly Scientology. He also has a twin brother who looks a lot like him but wears braces and is nothing like him. Is this very kind of nervous, retiring guy. And Steve Martin decides that what he can do is make a Kit Ramsey movie without ever telling Kit Ramsey that he's doing it. So he and his crew pop up in all kinds of locations and stage these action scenes without Eddie Murphy's cooperation, which, of course, makes him more paranoid, more frightened. It's a brilliantly written movie. Eddie Murphy is a great comic actor. This is the best you'll ever see him. I don't know why people don't know about this movie, but Bowfinger. If you don't laugh, well, contact me. I'll send you a quarter or something. I don't know. You have my personal guarantee.